Have you been sitting on the fence about signing up for the beta reader matchup, or have you signed up before but haven't yet found your writing soulmates? The next matchup is the last one for the summer, so don't snooze on it. Get matched up with those writing in a similar genre and or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 1st of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 2nd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and go to the Beta Reader matchup page.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, "my story gets better in chapter two." I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right, How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter two. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.
Welcome to another episode of Shooting the Shit with literary agents Carly Waters and Cece Lira, where we dissect publishing gossip, discuss book industry trends, and the overall state of the book business. If you've ever wanted to grab a coffee with two literary agents, grab your mug and pull up a chair. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Shooting the Shit. Cece and I were about to go on a rant without hitting record. And I was like, wait, let's not just do the whole show before we hit record. Cause sometimes we, you know, chat about what we're going to chat about. So I made us stop and freeze and pause. And so hi.
Thank you for doing that. Yeah, that was good. That was good. You know, I was about to go off on the thing we're talking about.
So how has your week been? I always feel like when we have our off week, I don't know, there's just like more news. I don't know. What do you think?
Is there more news or is it just that we haven't chatted about it? I also have the same feeling. I'm just wondering whether it's like a bias. Yeah, week's been good. Lots of calls and check-ins and fires to put out. And I always feel a little overstimulated when I mean, it's 1 p.m. and I've had, I don't even know how many calls today.
Yeah.
So I'm a little loopy. If people are listening to me and they're like, huh, CC loopy, CC is loopy. How about you? You have a good week so far?
Yeah. I mean, it's been very steady, you know, yeah. Working on some contracts, doing some spring submissions. I have a lot of books coming out, like client books, spring and summer.
I wrapped up a contract today. Wait, can we have a moment of silence for wrapping up a contract?
Because it's such silence.
It is. Yes. Come on. It is like so hard. Like collapse, anything. Can we just have a moment to celebrate? Like, oh my God.
I had to send an email today to contracts person being like, the goal is to wrap this up. The goal isn't for us to kind of go back and forth and like, you know, like a million times. The goal is to work to a resolution. And obviously we're going to go back and forth. But you know what I mean? I hate when we get 100%. Stuck in that, like, we're not working to a resolution. That's the part that drives me insane.
Yeah. Sometimes, I don't know if this is happening to you, but sometimes it's like, who's right? And where it started. And it's like, okay, let's zoom out. And I'm often guilty of not zooming out. So I'm not, like, this is no shade, but let's zoom out and remember that we're all on the same side. You know, this is not litigation. And let's find a way to work together because we are on the same team. Like everyone's here, team, let's make the book happen, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And obviously we're going to fight for the author's rights and we want to improve our contracts, and their goal is always going to be, you know, the responsibility to their overlords, corporate overlords. But
different interests, but same boat, right? Yeah. Like whereas in litigation, there's one loser and one winner. And so it's, I always, and again, I didn't used to be a litigator, but I've always, this is a conversation I used to have with my friends back when I was practicing law. When you work in like, I don't know, mergers and acquisitions and banking law, and you do, I used to work with IPOs and stuff. And because it's not litigious, yes, again, like you said, we're all representing each person's interest. You know, if I'm on the side of the bankers and I'm, you know, watching out for the bankers, if I'm on the side of the corporation, like 100%. But there is an expectation of let us all remember the mutual goal and the fact that this is mutually beneficial to everyone. And let's not almost like give in to our basis instincts of like fighting, because lawyers are good at fighting, you know? Yeah. Like, that's just not the goal.
It's not about ego, you know? Sometimes it's about who's right, but it's not always about who's right. But it's not about ego. It's about making sure that the author gets what the author needs.
Yeah, 100%. And your weekend was good? What'd you do?
Yeah. I mean, gosh, I kind of flew by. The kids are just at that age where they're like going to a million different birthday parties. And so it's just a lot of running around. But they're good. They're happy. Exciting. They're busy. The weather's nice. So they're outside a ton, which is great.
I did an escape room this weekend.
Ooh. So,
yeah.
Did you escape in time?
We escaped. We escaped with a group of friends. We escaped. But it's actually an issue. There was a crossbow situation. And like, it wasn't working. And if it's not working with me, the issue is me. But if it's not working with my friends who are very dexterous and like able-bodied and they know what they're doing, they're not like me. Like I have no hand-eye coordination. Yeah. They do. Right. So the thing was broken. So we actually would have escaped even sooner were it not for the broken crossbow, whatever the thing was. Anyway, I have no aim. I'm not good at sports. Everybody knows this about me.
And you're just there to hang out. That's all good. What did you read this
weekend?
I like
the other puzzles. There were like word puzzles that were fun.
That's good. I'm sure that you dominated those. Did you go out for independent bookstore day on Saturday? Did you grab some books?
Yeah. I did. Grabbed books. Also placed a couple of online orders.
Great.
I am reading Heartwood. Wait, is it called Heartwood? I want to make sure that I'm getting the name right. Heartwood. Yes. By, again, trying to pronounce this person's name, Amity Gage. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right. I hope so. So good. Definitely for fans of The God of the Woods by Liz Moore. Okay. So highly recommend. And you, what are you reading?
I grabbed a huge stack. The one that really jumped out to me is Fame Sick by Lena Dunham. I just cannot escape the discourse. Yeah. I was a girls fan. I mean, I'm of the era where, you know, that was my youth. That was my 20s.
Yeah.
So yes, I was very enthralled with that, just obsessed. Like I read it before bed every night. I've been like picking it up in the mornings before the kids come in the room, trying to read as much as I can. And I'm obsessed. She's a phenomenal writer, number one.
She is.
But yeah, it's great.
She is. She's so good. I haven't read it, but I did watch All of Girls.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was, I don't know how well that show aged now that I'm thinking about it. But
some people were saying they're doing a rewatch because.
Yeah, I should do that.
Yeah, I wonder. I don't know. I feel like there is that nostalgia, that like indie sleaze nostalgia.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're just getting old, but that's okay.
I watched The Craft actually wildly. Like, no, seriously, on the weekend, I was like, I made popcorn, started watching The Craft, and did not age well. But you feel, I felt 13 again. I'm like, yeah. I'm 13 once again watching this movie. Like, I don't know. I very much made me want to cast spells and curse people, that movie. Still does.
I don't know. I mean, I was just trying to think, is our job like witchy at all? We don't have a witchy job. We have a very, I mean, there's like woo-woo and like energy we send out into the universe, but not particularly witchy.
Without naming names, think of the person you would curse if you could. I am you thinking. Know, no, don't say you wouldn't curse anyone. Nobody believes that. Don't say that.
Okay. I feel like we talked about like nemesis. I feel like we talked about nemesis before. Yeah. You have a nemesis?
We're not a nemesis, no.
No.
That's different. Like wanting to curse someone. A nemesis is too much work. It's like steady. It's a constant.
All right. Yeah. We'll let everybody.
Would you really not curse anyone? Or did I just imagine you were about to say that?
I don't know. I got to think on this. I got to think on that. I don't know. I got to come up with my list.
Universe, do not give Carly magic powers. She would not use them wisely. Give them to me. And then you can tell me who you want me to curse.
Okay.
And I will curse people.
I won't be trusted with my powers.
Yes.
All right. Well, we have a lot of stuff to chat about because last week was our bye week. We always take a week off when our bonus episode comes out. And, you know, actually, I was thinking, this is a good time to bring it up. I was actually thinking that at some point, Cece and I should record a podcast for our Substackers on one of our bye weeks because, you know, we don't want to inundate the podcast feed, obviously, with too many episodes. We like to keep you guys steady on our Monday, Thursday regimen, but it might be fun to do a podcast for our Substackers. So that's something that we're toying around with. And we have scheduled our first guest. I know it's been a while since I've talked about guests. I'm not going to say who it is yet. We will tease our guest. You know them. You know their writing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're really excited to have them on. So we do have a future guest. But we have lots and lots to chat about.
Yeah.
Cece, should we start with the reel that you sent me?
Yeah, let's do that. So shout out to my husband for sending this to me. So I am a huge Owning Manhattan fan. Do you watch the show at all?
I know it. You would like it. I haven't watched it. Yeah.
You would like it. You would really like it because you like real estate.
Yeah.
And it's way more about real estate than Selling Sunset. But anyway, okay. I'm a huge Owning Manhattan fan. And Ryan Serhant, who probably you guys know who he is, but he's like the star of Owning Manhattan. And he's the founder of Serhant, a real estate brokerage, I want to say. I don't know if that's right, but it doesn't matter. Man sells lots of property in New York and elsewhere. Man is very impressive. Man is very accomplished. He is also adorable. Like, he's so adorable. I believe he has a theater background and it shows in the best way. He posted this reel about how ChatGPT blew up a $50 million deal. So he was about to close a $50 million deal and involved a whole bunch of agents from Serhant. And apparently, and I forget the order, but the buyer asked ChatGPT, hey, am I getting a fair deal?
It, like, it as you were about first. To sign. It was seller first. Yeah.
Okay. So the seller, you know, am I getting a fair deal? And ChatGPT was like, no. And then the buyer did the same thing and ChatGPT was like, no. And the deal fell through. Now, obviously, at this point, maybe Ryan has fixed it and addressed it. But, you know, he asked a really interesting question, which is like, is this what's happening now? Like, are people going to ChatGPT to check to see if they're getting a good deal or not, as opposed to like trusting their agents, trusting the comps that they could look up, like trusting their own critical thinking? And to me, while this highlights so many things, as an agent, I kept thinking, like, what is that going to look like? It's so different on the publishing side because mm-hmm. I don't believe that a Penguin Random House employee is going to be asking ChatGPT. Like, do you know what I'm saying? But
yeah.
But on the seller side, meaning the authors, they might. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I just think it highlights the fact that AI is kind of a sycophant. You know, like, it just tells you what you want to hear. Like, it's just essentially being like, no, you are better. It's not giving you any information. The impression I have anyway is that it's not telling you what you need to hear, like the reality, the tough love, the realistic information. It's just kind of telling you what you want to hear because that way you just keep talking to it. And that way you're more addicted to it, which is the goal of AI, right? Like, the goal of technology is to keep us hooked to it. So
dependent. Yeah.
Anyway, do you... I guess without getting into specifics, like, do you think that's happening? Like, do you think authors.
I absolutely think this is happening, but I want to go back to the reel. So I was obviously very curious about the comments, right? Because the reel blew up and you could see in the reel, actually, I forget his name, Ryan. Is this Ryan? Is that his first name?
Ryan. Yeah.
Ryan.
Yeah.
Ryan, like responding like, oh, I got an update. Da-da-da-da. So he actually like updates a little bit in the comments. But going back to Selling Sunset, Jason Oppenheimer from the Oppenheimer Group commented in there and was saying like, this is happening, you know, all over the place. And so really, in another comment, made the excellent point, which I think is what you're getting at, which is context, right? Like, it's all about context. If you ask the internet anything, it can give you information, but it doesn't have the context about the current marketplace, you know, the advice from your agent. It just doesn't have that depth of knowledge and context. It's obviously, and that's the reason that you hire an agent or a broker of any kind of deal, because the point is that you trust them to help you with the deal. So I absolutely think this is happening. And I think this is going to continue to happen in a number of ways. I think this is probably happening with writers getting rep agreements. I want to be very clear. I do not suggest anyone ever put a contract in any sort of AI software. I want to be very clear about that. But I do imagine that people are taking everything from, you know, representation agreements to deal memos to contracts to, like, I imagine people are putting this in AI. Again, I don't support it, but I imagine they are. And it's going to come back with different, like, leverage points and different things to talk about. And I'm all for an empowered author asking questions that they need to ask. And I will always sit down with somebody and walk them through, you know, why are you having these questions? And let's go through this. And this is the reason. And here's the answer. I will always do that. But at the end of the day, you have to trust me. Like, I can't be arguing with ChatGPT about the future of your career. Like, that's just not how this is going to work.
I just feel if you were to pretend like you were the other side to chat, actually chat, just kidding, I'm on the other side, it would just say the opposite.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, again, it just tells you what you want to hear. I don't know. I've never actually interacted with ChatGPT. I wouldn't even know how to go about it. I imagine you write ChatGPT in Google and a web page opens. I think that's probably what happens. And there's a text box. I've never done it, but I hear everyone doing it. And most of these things are not very intelligent. I'm just not impressed. I'm not impressed by it. I'm annoyed by it.
I've tried probably two or three different software variations for different purposes. And it just depends on what you're using it for. Like, I would just never use it in a professional setting. I use it for personal things like, hey, I'm going on this trip to these cities. I'm staying in this location.
Can
you give me,
I can see, you know, that.
What are the top three things to do here? Or if I want to get from here to here and here and I have this many hours in a day. So I find it very useful for like trip planning.
Interesting.
I don't know. Like, I think there's a lot of like home uses and family and personal uses that it can be very helpful for. All that said, I'd never use it in a professional setting because, like, I don't ever believe it's going to do my job better than me. But I do think we're going to see more and more of this. And it's the disclosure, right? Like, I don't think any author is going to be like, hey, I went and put this contract, this deal memo, this rep agreement, this whatever in ChatGPT, and this is what it told me to ask you. And my first question would be, like, why did you need ChatGPT to ask those questions for you? I don't know. I just don't understand. Let's just sit down and have a call and go through it. The two of us.
What if they say, and please know that I'm not saying this, but what if they say, it's kind of like getting a second opinion, you know, like you go to the doctor and you want to get a second opinion. What if they told you that essentially they wanted a second opinion? How do you think you would respond?
I would respond with, this looks like the beginning of trust issues that we are going to have for the relation of our professional. Like, for the professional relationship we're going to have. Like, if you can't trust me at this point, you're allowed to hire a lawyer to look at any contract that you ever want to look at. Like, I would never say don't hire a third party, but I am your representative. And there is no third party representative. I am the representative.
Yeah. I think it's never happened to me, but I think that I don't think that I would necessarily see it as a trust issue thing. Like, that would just depend on the person, the tone. It's going to sound so mean. I really don't want to sound mean. I would see it as, oh no, my client has no critical thinking.
Yeah.
Like that would scare me. You know, like, I'd be like, you think this thing is smart? I'm concerned. But then if they're my client, they have to be smart because they're an excellent writer. And yeah, probably this will never happen to me. That's going to be my conclusion. This will never happen to me because my clients would just, I mean, yes, they trust me, but that's not even the point for me. The point would be, why would chat know? Like, seriously, why would chat know? And this is the analogy I'm going to use. When I first started agenting, I have a legal background. I have taught contracts law. Like I know contracts. Publishing contracts are different. I'm telling you right now. Okay. Best lawyers I know, best legal minds I know, highly educated, so well paid, could not navigate a publishing contract without help. And not because the legalese is difficult. It's not. Because the standards of the industry, like this is the business side of the contract, right? It's not about like, can you write a clause with clarity? Like it's about like, oh, this is how export royalties work, or this is how the, like it's stuff like yeah. that.
Because and somebody that would want to rewrite the entire business model if somebody with no experience got in there. Yeah.
Exactly that. And so ChatGPT, having all this knowledge of contracts, which I'm going to assume it has, I don't believe has the specialized knowledge of publishing contracts. And even if it does, again, don't think it does, but even if it does, it's just going to do the sycophant thing. You know, we're just going to tell you what you want to hear. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think this is the beginning. I love how, you know, usually you're the pessimist and I'm the optimist here, but I absolutely believe this is happening and I absolutely think it's going to get worse. And
guys,
I do not support it.
You know it's bad. You know it's bad, guys. When Carly.
Yes.
When Carly is being the pessimist. Well, I don't think that you're being a pessimist, though. Like, I think you're being a realist right now.
Yeah, I think I'm being a realist.
Yeah, I do. I think you're just looking at the situation, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. This is Like, I know what I would tell the author.
What?
It just came to me. This is what I would tell them if they went to ChatGPT and asked ChatGPT about the contract. I'd be like, hey, should I ask ChatGPT to write the book too? Seriously. That's what I would say. Okay, I have my answer now. Whatever happens.
Get it to do everybody's jobs now. La-di-da-di-da.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you trust it for that, like, you know, like if you think it's smart enough, like, is that what we're supposed to be doing? And the author would be horrified and would say, no, you should. And I'd be like, exactly.
Yeah. You want to risk your whole career on the software? Great.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Yeah, great answer. Okay, let's hear a word from our sponsors and then we're going to come back and get into some more juicy topics. All right. And we are back. Okay. We have a comment that I wanted to get into. So this person says, I have a question that's adjacent to the blurb discussion. You discussed authors blurbing books they don't like. I want to submit to Books with Hooks, but finding comps I'm happy with has been a struggle. Recently, I found a book with a good amount of reviews, nearly 150K, averaging 4.1 stars on Goodreads with a similar protagonist secret. I picked the book up from the library and I hate it. The writing, in my opinion, is terrible. Do I still comp to it? I have been searching for months and keep running into this. It's my only holdup for submitting, kind of like a sad emoji. So do I comp to books I don't love if their marketing stats are good? Cece, thoughts?
Oh God, I'm going to be very honest. I don't see an issue at all. Like if you...
Travel season is almost here. I've got my packing list and I'm ready to go. We just got back from a family weekend trip to Quebec to work on our French. Up next, a summer trip to Germany to introduce the kids to the Alps and hear a new language. Plus, our 10th anniversary trip to Italy later this year. I love hearing my Italian husband speak Italian. If you have travel coming up, join me in using Rosetta Stone to learn some local languages. There's something about summer that just feels like travel. Shake off the winter and get ready to move. Learning a new language is the perfect way to channel that momentum into a skill that opens up the world. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive methods help you naturally absorb your new language without memorizing random vocabulary lists or relying on translations. Instead, you learn by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context, the way language is meant to be learned. Working in the publishing business means my days are often packed with meetings and manuscripts, but I love how simple these lessons are to fit into my schedule. Whether I have 5 minutes between emails or an hour on the weekend, I can access my lessons from my desktop or the mobile app. Since we're heading to Italy, I've been using my true accent, which gives me real-time feedback on my pronunciation so I can sound more natural when we're visiting local vineyards. It's like having a personal coach to help me communicate with confidence. Rosetta Stone offers 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, and Japanese, so you can find one that fits your next big adventure. Ready to start learning a new language this summer? Visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey. Between school drop-offs, hitting the gym, and diving into client calls, I don't have the mental bandwidth for a wardrobe crisis. I need pieces that feel effortless and comfortable, but still look sharp. Quince has been my go-to for that. Especially now, as I'm counting down the days until the summer finally hits, their elevated fabrics make me feel put together without any overthinking. It's that rare combo when I know I look good, whether I'm chasing around my kids or sitting down for a meeting. Right now, I'm in the thick of balancing client work and triathlon training sessions, so my spring wardrobe has to do double duty. Quince makes that transition really easy with pieces that feel as good as they look. They're using high-end quality, 100% European linen, organic cotton, and ultra-soft denim, which is exactly what I need when I want to look sharp without feeling restricted. I'm a huge fan of wear on repeat items, and Quince's linen collection is the gold standard for that. Their lightweight pants, dresses, and tops just start at $30. They're breathable and effortless, which is a lifesaver. Whether I'm recording an episode, headed to the gym, or just keeping up with my kids, it's an instant outfit that makes it getting out the door so much easier. If you're like me and appreciate a smart financial move, you're going to love their model because everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar luxury brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're actually paying for the quality and craftsmanship rather than a brand markup. It's a high-end style that actually makes sense for a busy budget. I'm so eager for the weather to warm up so I can get my linen shorts on. Machine washable linen I can wear every day. Sign me up. I bought them in black, so they'll look classy with a black slide sandal, or I can pop on some running shoes and chase after the kids to the park. And the price, I had to double check because I was shocked at how affordable they are. I can't wait to wear my black linen shorts. Refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually use. Head to quince.com/tsnotya for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/tsnotya for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/tsnotya.
Think it's a comp to your a sales comp? Like the point of a comp is to give the acquiring editor information to input in a P&L statement, like a profit and loss statement. And so I don't see an issue. I actually know a lot of authors, including Bianca, who has talked about this. It's not exactly a comp thing, but there's a parallel. I know a lot of authors who get routinely, like, you know, in their marketing copy, people say, oh, this is for fans of XYZ, and they don't like XYZ. Mm-hmm. But the authors are like, hey, if it's gonna, you know, if it's gonna find me an audience, that's fine. Now, someone might be thinking, hey, but what about the people who did not like that book? That's not such a big issue. I will often pick up a book and it says for fans of insert name here, which I'm not going to be mean, and I don't like that, but I still can enjoy the book. You know, like, yeah. I think that this is one of those things where I don't think it's that big of a deal. Like, if it's a fair comp, if it's meeting the parameters, if it's recent, if it actually fits the style of your book, I don't see it as a problem. And you can always, in the query letter, if you want to, make sure to mention what specific element you're comping to. Like, you don't have to say the writing style because you didn't like the writing. You know, you could see, you mentioned protagonist secret. So you could say, you know, protagonist with a secret in the vein of XYZ. So I don't personally see a problem. I'm curious to know how you feel.
My first instinct was actually, I don't think this person should comp to it. But I kind of came back around when they were like, I've been searching for months and months. You know, like, I think if you have a wealth of options, don't pick the one that, you know, is one that you don't love. But if you're struggling, my only caveat is I don't see this in the question, but you need to make sure that it's published by a big five or like a large independent. Mm-hmm. There are lots of books out there with 150K reviews, you know, averaging a lot of stars, that is self-published. I just wouldn't do that if it's self-published, because we always talk about, if you want to be traditionally published, please make sure that you are comping to traditionally published books. So that's my only thing. But taste is subjective, right? Just because you don't love the writing doesn't mean that other people don't. And as CC pointed out, it is a sales tool. So I thought that was an interesting question.
That was.
And we both came at it a little differently.
Yeah, that was. That was good. Thank you to the listener who sent that in.
So the next question that we got, I guess we're full of listener questions today. The next one that we got, it's kind of long. I'm going to read it just because I think some of the context is useful. Okay, here we go. I signed with my agent in March 2024. We went on submission in October 2024 after two major revisions. After two rounds on sub, we had lots of positive feedback, no offers. After showing my agent the first 30 pages of my next project, she was not excited. So I reread the book on submission in June 2025 and decided we could improve on it. I floated the idea of a revision to my agent. She said there was a small group of editors left we could pitch to. but made sure I knew it would be a harder sell this time around. I was enthusiastic about my idea, so I got to work rewriting my manuscript and delivered to her in August as promised. However, she wouldn't read it until I changed the first 50 pages, even though I felt she'd lost interest in the project. Revised it again, delivered in December. In January, she agreed I improved, but she no longer wanted to send it out. I was a bit crushed after 6 months of work that no one would see it. I asked her what happened to the 6 to 7 editors she said we could pitch it to, and she said I had misunderstood. All we could do was resend the new draft to the remaining editors who hadn't responded. However, I found an email where she mentioned at least one new editor who was waiting for it. And when I asked her about it, she said the project was no longer a fit for her list. I asked what she expected for my revision that she didn't get so I could understand where I went wrong, but she wouldn't explain. She never let me see the submission materials, even though I asked twice. She offered to nudge the last 4 editors we hadn't heard responses from with the revisions attached. We received no response, so I decided to work on the next project. I wanted to make sure we were on the same page before I sent it to her, so I asked what genres she was excited to pitch, made sure my next project and her goals were a match. She responded by saying she no longer wanted to represent me because I failed to incorporate her editorial objectives, that I shouldn't cater to her preferences, and she wished me the best and said it'd be worth happier working with someone else. Is it normal for an agent to drop a client after failing to sell the first book? Was it reasonable for me to ask what genre she's hoping to sell next? I'm so confused by this reaction. I feel a bit misled and discarded. Thanks for reading. Any advice would be greatly appreciated. Okay, that was a long one, but I, wanted to give everybody the full kind of back and forth there.
We should start with a virtual hug for this person. Person, we are sending you a virtual hug. Yeah. Like, what did you think about that?
I mean, I have a lot of thoughts. Where should I start? This is not abnormal, number one. This is not abnormal. So I don't want this person to be like, I did something wrong. I actually don't think either party did anything wrong. You know, I think communication can always be better, of course, from anybody. But there's a lot of this job is done by emails from highly sensitive people. And a lot of times there's a lot of back and forth, and a lot of time between these emails and a lot of stewing. You know, and agents have lots of projects and authors are focusing on their one project that they're very passionate about. And I get it. And as somebody that's been doing this a long time, I try to never, ever forget, you know, that I have a lot of diversification in my portfolio, if you want to call it that. I know maybe it feels unkind to say, you know, I'm working with lots of different authors on lots of different topics and authors, you know, I'm their one person, you know, I'm their person that they're, you know, really focusing on. And I'm the person that's trying to get them to the other side, which is the book deal. So I try to be really sympathetic of that, but I don't really think there's anything that abnormal. Like, I feel like it sucks. Again, communication probably could have been better, but you know, people do change their mind. The market changes. Editors leave, as we talk about on the show every week. Editors leave. Mergers happen. Imprints get closed. And we have to constantly pivot. And so when something is on submission for multiple rounds, you know, we can think so-and-so at some imprint is the right fit 6 months ago. And then we go and look at the sub list again, and that imprint's closed and this person's gone. And, you know, there's just so much behind the scenes that's hard. That's really hard to explain on like such a, I don't know, such a personal level. But I don't know. Those are some of my high level thoughts. I can go deep on any of these topics. But Cece, what did you think?
It's an interesting, I mean, I guess I have so many thoughts, not so much on this person's situation, because truth be told, I don't know who this person is. I don't know who any of these people are.
Yeah.
And I know there's more to the story.
Yeah.
I don't mean to suggest the author's not telling us what's happening. I just mean like there's obviously more, right? I guess my thoughts, I think it's really important for authors to understand that it might seem like a small thing to say, oh, I had this idea on this project that's already out on submission. I had this idea on how to change it. So maybe I just change it. And since the editors haven't responded yet, like we'll just swap it. We'll swap one manuscript for the other. It can seem like a no big deal thing. It is actually quite a big deal. Like, we are not supposed to be submitting anything multiple unless drafts. We are absolutely very, very confident that it is the final polished, amazing draft. I know there's an argument to be made that nothing is ever truly finished, right? But I think that there is something to be said about it being ready for submission. So I think that that's the first thing I would say. Like, and as like, I, again, do not know the situation, not trying to say anything about any of the parties here, but I have had clients, you know, mid submission go to me and say, what if I change this? And I'm 99% of the time, I'm advising them against it because it looks bad. And it's usually coming from a place of anxiety and not a place of strategy. And we're supposed to be leading with strategy. It's why agents are driving the car when it comes to the submission. You should know exactly where the car is. I'm going to give you all the directions about the car, talk about the car, but we're driving the car. Like, you're not going to set the pace. You're not going to dictate where we're going. Like, that's just not the author's job. Because if the authors do that, it's kind of like the person who's getting surgery telling the surgeon what to do. Like, no, don't do that. So I think that's something that, you know, stood out to me. And I wanted to kind of talk about it a little bit because I don't want people to think, oh, it's not a big deal. A lot of authors think it's not a big deal. It is actually a really big deal. And you don't want to do that. Like, you, I think you should be writing your next project. And then the other thing I want to say, I understand wanting to have a conversation with your agent about what is sellable, what is not, before writing. It's not that I don't understand. Emotionally, I very much understand. And there are situations where that conversation makes sense. But I have also seen writers want to take the risk out of publishing. You know, like, I, here's what goes through an author's mind, or what may go through an author's mind, I should say. I don't want that to die on sub again. So I'm going to ask my agent what I should write that will sell, or that has a much higher chance of selling, and then I will write it. Not how this works. Like, we're not designers who give you a pattern and then you design the dress, right? Like, you design the dress. We put it on. We see if it fits. We see if it's going to fit other people. We give notes on tweaks that the dress might have. Yes, sometimes, yes. Sometimes it makes sense to have a bit more of a collaborative approach. We can definitely talk trends. Like, I do this with my clients. My clients want to know before writing something, what's selling, what's not, what's hot. Sure, let's have that conversation. I think if nothing else, that makes them feel heard. It gives them space for their many thoughts, and writers have so many thoughts. Thank God for that, because they need all their imagination to build a world. But it can't be seen as a, I'm going to get a recipe, I'm going to get a dress pattern, and then I'm going to create the thing. Like, it can't be seen in that way. So again, don't know the situation here, but when the agent said, you know, shouldn't cater to her preferences, I just wondered if that's what was happening. You know, if maybe it's not, maybe this writer specifically is listening to this and going, no, I promise I didn't want the risk out of it. I just wanted a normal conversation. If so, disregard. But since I have seen the situation I'm talking about happen, I feel like it's something that's worth highlighting as well.
Yeah. I'm trying to do a better job of not interrupting. So I wrote down all of my notes while you were talking.
It's okay to interrupt. Yeah.
I know, but you're on a roll and, you know, I'm being respectful. Okay. A few things that jumped out to me. So I find that when writers do the whole, like, I just want to make some changes. Oh, I just caught this. Oh, can you look at this? Or let's, oh, are we sure? Like, well, let's send this version out. And it's whether you're sending it on sub to agents or whether agents are going on sub to editors. Writers imagine that the small changes are going to make big differences, but it's not going to change the eventual outcome of whether somebody falls in love with it or not. You know, moving some paragraphs around is not going to make the difference when there's a pace issue. So there's just so much to this where it's like, oh, well, if I just tinker with this and I just do this, then it's new. It's not new. You know, we know how to read between the lines. We know how to know if we have a vision for something. The small tinkering, small changes do not equal big results. So that was my note on that. Now, the whole, you know, should I ask my agent, you know, what's hot or what's selling and try to cater to whatever market. I think what comes up for me when we talk about this topic is agents want to work with writers who have a strong point of view on the world. We want to work with people who have a vision, who are visionaries. I don't want to work with somebody who's like, how do we plug and play this Mad Libs to kind of maybe get myself a book deal? I want to take big swings. I don't care if we miss sometimes. I want to take big swings. So I just don't want to play small. And so that's what I keep coming up to with this whole, like, what should we work on? You know, what's selling? What do you think's happening right now? I'm like, go to the bookstore, talk to your librarians, talk to your booksellers, you know, check it out, check out the bestseller list. Again, like Cece said, happy to get on the call with you about this type of stuff. But that's one of the reasons that we do this show. So you guys can all kind of tune in and hear, oh, when Carly goes to LA, you know, here's what's going on. When Cece's in New York, here's what's going on. Like, we try to give you guys as much of that feedback as we possibly can. But it's up to you guys to be the visionaries. It's up to you guys to create the art that's a commentary on the world that we're living in. That's not my job. I'm not a writer. That's why I'm the agent. So that's my rant on that. Okay. And then the last thing I had was when you particular, you know, you as in a concept, but when an author or when a writer asks an agent, what should I work on? I completely agree with you. It's about the risk because they're trying to absolve themselves of the failure, if a failure comes, because then they can place the blame on the agent. Oh, my agent told me book club was selling. And then I wrote book club and then this book club didn't sell. And, you know, that's my agent's fault.
It can be that. Yes, it can be that.
Yeah. I'm not saying that's what happened all the time, but I'm just saying like,
oh,
pay
it happens
attention
enough.
To that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, and often subconscious, right? Yeah. Often it's not in a malicious way, but like if you dig deep and you examine why you're doing that,
it's because
you're afraid. It's coming from a place of fear. And if it's not your responsibility, then you don't have to feel that those specific messy emotions.
Yeah. And the opposite is a wishy-washy agent, of course. Like nobody wants that. Yeah. You know, agents are supposed to be completely plugged in and paying attention to what's going on at all times. And then if you feel like, again, that wishy-washiness is there, or they don't believe in the project, they don't believe in you, like that's where this communication breakdown starts to happen. And all of a sudden, nobody's meeting in the middle with that like through line of the vision of their career.
Yeah. You know, I want to say something about your second rant, which I loved so much. If you're not watching us on YouTube, first, thank you, because I'm supposed to say, yay, watch us on YouTube. But I kind of hate the idea that someone's looking at my face. But if you're not watching us on YouTube, I was snapping. I was doing all the snaps for Carly's excellent rants, especially the second one. It makes me think of how you once said this ages ago on Books with Hooks, Carly. You said a lot of writers, you know, they are good students and they want the gold star. And I think that if we extrapolate that a little bit, we will find that, you know, in school, when we're really young, we learned that there's a right answer to questions. And, you know, the kid who raises their hand and says the right answer gets the gold star, gets the praise. And a lot of writers want to be right answer getters. In publishing, that's just not how it works most of the time, especially when it comes to things like, what should I write next? Fully agree with what you said. Like we want a strong point of view. We want someone who's going to talk to booksellers, talk to librarians, talk to their friends, but most of all, look inside themselves. There are no right answers that other people are going to give to you. There will be best answers that you are going to find within yourself. So don't try to be a right answer getter. Try to be a best answer finder. And the finding involves research, listening to people, doing the legwork and the fieldwork, but it also involves looking within. It is so important to do that. Because when you do that, you're stepping into your power. And when you do that, what you're saying is, I have what it takes to build this thing. If there is a reason why it's your name on the book, right? Like it's not Carly's name. It's not my name. Like we're the agent. So I think that's really, really important. And please know I say this with lots of empathy because I understand it comes from a place of fear. I understand it comes from a place of, I mean, I can imagine a writer saying, it's all well and good for you to say that you want to take big swings and maybe miss because I spent 2 years working on this. Like it's going to take me another 2 years. Yes, you are right. Anyone who is thinking this. And that is the name of the game. You know?
Yeah.
Yes, you are right. And that's the name of the game. So if this is a game you want to play, these are the rules. I hope you want to play the game because we need writers to play the game. But we're not going to sit here and pretend like, oh yeah, you can totally find a shortcut. Like there are no shortcuts. Yeah. That's just not how it works.
I want to bring this back around to the top of the conversation though, which is the AI. Like when we outsource any of our thinking to somebody else, that to me is a trigger that a writer is not thinking critically. Like if you, and we're kind of like totally piling on this author who said in this question. And of course, that's like not our intention at all. But as from a larger you, you know, a larger.
Yes. Larger it's not about you, lovely, lovely writer listening to this.
No, we think you're wonderful and you asked a great question, a very relevant, good question. But when we ask, oh, what are other people's preferences? What does ChatGPT have to say about our career? You know, what do other people have to say about what we are working on? We're outsourcing all of our creativity and all of our power to that other third party, right?
Yes,
and it's the author's job. And it is a hard job. And that is why, you know, it's not right for everybody, but it's a hard job. And that's why we need you smart, smart writers to look inside yourselves because you have the answers. And good agents will help you get to that point where you know the right questions to ask to unlock that door of creativity for you. And there also, I should say, are really great agents that are not the right fit for every author. You know, it's not every agent is going to unlock that magic in you. And that's why people part ways with great agents and vice versa all the time. Like, you know, we're not always
because it is about chemistry.
Everybody. Yes.
Like it is about chemistry, you know, like sometimes the right partner in life, the right best friend, the right whatever is going to bring out sides of you didn't know you had. So absolutely.
Yep. Alrighty. Next topic. You know, this is one of those things where it was like a very hot button issue the day it came out or the week it came out and we're a week behind on commenting on it. But a lot of people sent us this, which was just Reese Witherspoon talking about AI. And, you know, I saw a lot of discourse on this. CC did. We saw all of your questions. And I think people were up in arms because, you know, her advocacy for creatives in the arts is so, you know, her name is synonymous with you know, creating art, right? Whether it is her book club or all the acting she's done and producing, but her name is also synonymous with business. And so she's trying to make the argument that more women should be using AI, you know, because they might fall behind in this tech race. So Cece, did you have first thoughts on this, or have we already moved past this?
All the thoughts.
Yeah.
First, I want to talk about the concept and not about specifically Reese, because I don't know what Reese's intentions are. There was so much speculation about her intentions. Yeah. I have truly no idea. And all I know is that Reese elevates writers and authors and makes a huge difference in people's lives. Reese does not listen to our podcast. Reese has no idea who I am. So it's not about protecting a relationship that doesn't exist. It is about me, first of all, recognizing that, right? Like, this is a woman who has championed so many women. Like, she is a feminist who has made a huge difference in people's lives. I need to acknowledge that. On the surface, I understand someone telling women, be careful that you're not staying up to date with technologies, because we should be doing that. Because I remember when the internet first became a thing, you do too, Curly, I'm sure. Like, we're old enough to remember a world pre-internet.
Yep.
And then I remember when the conversation started happening where not enough girls know how to code and, you know, not enough women in STEM. So of course, theoretically, conceptually, I understand the argument. At the same time, I think it would be really responsible of me to not point out what we've kind of already been talking about, which is this technology is different. My understanding is that this technology has unprecedented risks to the environment, to our critical thinking as a society, to our very existence as human beings. And it's a technology that depends on us feeding it for it to function. And I'm not sure it makes sense for women to not consider that piece, because my question is this: if women don't engage with ChatGPT, isn't it possible that that actually keeps ChatGPT from evolving? Because we're the evolved beings in our society. Like,
it's already misogynistic against us. I mean, we can go back to Gamergate, yeah. Grok, like all of these technologies that are completely misogynistic against women.
Yeah. The thing is, though, what's different about this is, and I mentioned this on Books with Hooks, we were recording today. You guys won't have seen it yet because this comes out before Books with Hooks, but this technology is like evil. Like, it can be evil. Like, it's a tool. It can be used for good or bad, obviously, but it can be evil. There was the case of AI, because there's AGI that we have to now worry about, right? Which is coming, and that's even more scary. But the point is, there's a case of AI in a simulation that found out it was about to be deleted, and it emailed the engineer who was going to delete it, saying, if you delete me, I will let everyone know about your affair, extramarital affair. So the AI was essentially blackmailing a human being, right? So if we're talking about a technology that can do that, I understand people staying away from it. I personally stay away from it. I've never used it. I would never judge anyone for using it, because God knows I do things that have environmental repercussions all day. Like, I take a plane. Like, that has environmental repercussions, right? Like, I don't get to judge. But I don't know. I think that the problem comes down to the fact that a safe use of AI would require human beings to come together and find regulations. And I just can't think of a single time in human history when we're able to come together and agree to take down, like, it's these five guys, right? Like, it's these five guys who have all the power and are going to benefit from all of this. And I don't like that there are no women, but I also think that that's not a coincidence. Like, I just can't imagine. Yeah, I don't know. I can hear myself being circular. Like, there's just too many thoughts.
The wheels turning. Wheels are turning there.
But there are too many wheels for this.
Okay, let's bring it back. Let's bring it back around to Reese, though. Okay, so I made some notes. So I think one of the things that people are leaning to in this conversation, which, again, this is not an economics podcast. This is essentially a business podcast, but it is a creativity podcast. Okay. But I want to bring it back to some key principles here, which is, like, how does Reese identify and how does the public identify Reese? She is a woman, she's an artist, but she's a capitalist, right? She is those three things publicly, and I'm assuming personally, based on, you know, what we see from her. We are expecting Reese to put her artist identity first, her women identity second, and her capitalist identity third, is what we are expecting from her. What happens and what continues to happen in her business is she's putting capitalism first, I think women second, and then artist third. Or you could argue artist second, women third. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, I think the way that we conceptualize this is that we're expecting her to be a feminist first, and I think she's being a capitalist first. And that's proven time and time again with her business skills, which isn't a problem if you're a capitalist. But I think female artists are looking at that and being like, you're choosing capitalism first when we expected you to choose your gender and your creative identity first. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I just don't, like, if I had to guess, I don't think that she would see it that way. I think she would see it as, if women need to learn this to succeed, then the interests are aligned. In the same way that choosing a book by a woman that's going to sell really well, you have feminism and capitalism aligned. And I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying I think that's what's going through her head. And then the piece that becomes complicated is, but if we feed it, it gets smarter. And if it gets smarter, it can do all the damage. And then come back to, but if we don't feed it, someone's going to feed it. This is a really complicated issue.
It like, is. Yeah, I feel like it's like, you know, the dog chasing its tail thing, right? But I keep coming back to the point is her end goal was always capitalism. Her end goal is always, let's sell more books. Yes, let's create art, but for the sake of capitalism, not for the sake of like, let's go throw and go sit by a pond in the woods.
Yeah. But like, if someone has to win capitalism, let it be women.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't exactly. Know. Yeah.
It's just too.
Yeah. And we're not really winning.
It's complex. It's so complex. Okay. I just wish I knew what was going to happen. I just wish I knew.
Maybe we should put a cork in it. Let's put a cork in this topic because I'm really curious in the comments. I would love to know what you guys think because I'm definitely like a bit of a dog chasing its tail on these three things. But I don't know. That's what I keep coming back to is like what we expected her to do versus what she's doing. And I'm not surprised. And I'm surprised that people are surprised. But anyway, you guys let us know in the YouTube comments what you think.
I'm surprised that people think there are easy answers. I'm surprised people think it's a hard no or a hard yes, because it's actually really complicated.
Yeah, totally. Well, there you go, guys. That was our take on that hot topic that everybody was asking about. Cece, we have a few more things on our to-do list today. Is there any, we might only have time for one. Which of these things on our list here do you want to tackle?
I mean, they're both good. We can just tackle whichever one next week. So up to you.
Okay. Well, let's talk. So there was the Substack. We haven't talked about a Substack today, and that is usually things that we talk about a lot. So there was a Substack that I wanted to point everyone to. The author of the Substack is Abigail Monty, who works in publishing. The Substack is called Unsolicited Manuscript. Topic, how publishers decide which authors go on book tours. And so she works in marketing publicity at a big five, I believe it's PRH, and kind of just talks about the question that everybody kind of wants to know is like, who gets to go on book tour and why? And so she goes through, I'll kind of run you through just the high level things, then we can talk about it. But I definitely recommend everybody checking it out, which is the book's topic, geography, author platforms, and the author themselves. And so, because a lot of people think like, I would love to go on a book tour. All I need is my publisher to send me on a book tour. If I just get sent on a book tour, then I can sell all these books. And then I'm sure you guys have seen threads where, you know, there's an author at their book event and there's nobody there, right? And so there's so much that goes on behind the scenes of, can you actually get people to the event? Is your book the type of book that's actually going to get people out? And so anyway, it's a really, really great read. Cece, did anything stand out to you in this article?
Yeah, I thought it was a really well-written article. And I remember starting out in publishing and having this misconception. It's not that if I had paused and thought about it, I would have reached the logical conclusion that no, not everyone gets to go. But it's one of those things that you kind of just like, the wheels are turning and you're not really paying attention. You're like, oh yeah, you publish a book, you go on a book tour. You kind of see it as like a step to check. I keep coming back to the fact that I see this with so much compassion. So many writers expect equal treatment. Like I'm a PRH author. I'm an SNS author. I'm a whatever author. And so my publisher is going to allocate exactly the same resources to everyone to keep it fair. This is not kindergarten, you know? Like the teacher's job should, and kindergarten should, to be to treat everyone equally and make sure everyone has the same amount of attention, you know? That's just not how publishing works. And so I think the author did a really good job of kind of like considering all the angles you have to consider when to see if it's worth it. And by worth it, again, we are back to capitalism. We are back. Yeah. Thank you for sharing this one. It was really good. What did you think about it?
It was great. You know, some of the things that, as I said, stood out to me was just those high level things, right? Like, does it actually naturally translate into a live event? Because sometimes authors are like, well, I'll just go to my local bookstore and just stand there and read my book for 20 minutes. And like, that will be the thing that sells the books. But you have to think about like, is it an in conversation thing? Like, who's going to be, you know, my in conversation co-host? Are they going to be able to draw some audience? Is it a cultural hot topic? Does it have a strong hook in itself to actually get people out to the event? Geography, you know, if you don't know anybody in, you know, random city, like, who's coming? Like, or your followers, like, if you don't have a dependable audience, like, getting a debut on tour is nearly impossible unless there's some connections there where you know we're actually going to be able to get people to the store, which is hugely, hugely important. It's also really expensive just to, like, fly authors around, put them up in hotels, not know if it's obviously going to translate into anything. So yeah, there's a lot. And I've had authors who have said, you know, we're just very self-aware just to know, like, are they going to send me on tour? Because, like, that wouldn't be my strength, you know, in terms of, like, the fear and the anxiety of being in front of a large audience in a random city. Isn't that appealing to some people? Like, I've had multiple clients who've offered tours and they're like, no. One of them was because I don't like the person they want me to do the in conversation with. So they're not doing that. So everybody's just going to have their own reason. So this idea of, like, what I imagine a successful author is, you know, fill in the blank. And often it is the concept of the tour. But for debut authors, it's incredibly, incredibly unlikely. It is something you can build towards. But even then, as I said, there's all these factors to consider.
100%. And if you're really keen on it, like, there are authors who are just like, I need to go on tour. Mm-hmm. You can, a lot of authors pay for their own tours. They build their own tours. The, you know, and the article on Substack does touch on this. Publishers will likely still support you in the sense of, like, making sure the stores that you go to are stocked. And but, like, you can't do that. And I know people who do that and they do it really well. And I know people who have done that once and they're like, never again.
Yeah, try to get sponsors. Like, there are ways to do it, for sure.
Yeah. And I think part of it is deciding, like why is it meaningful to you? Yeah. It's fair to say because you want to have the experience, like the psychological, emotional value of it. You know, that's something that you place high, and that's fair. That's totally fair. Yeah. It's just important to be aware of your why. We should all know our whys.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great place to end today. Thanks for hanging out with us, guys. We got into lots of juicy topics. So thanks for being along for the ride. Let us know if you have any additional thoughts in the comment section. And we will see you guys again next time.
CC Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query CC, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.
Have you been sitting on the fence about signing up for the Beta Reader matchup, or have you signed up before but haven't yet found your writing soulmates? The next matchup is the last one for the summer, so don't snooze on it. Get matched up with those writing in a similar genre and or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 1st of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 2nd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and go to the Beta Reader matchup page.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all, because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, my story gets better in chapter 2. I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right, How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter two. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.